Public hearing, possible work session on Senate Bill 1098. Jan Lee, Tom Viner, and Dee, are you also involved?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Jan Lee with Oregon Water Resources Congress. This bill may look familiar to you because it was out of your committee last session as Senate Bill 1154. It did two things. It allows people who use the conservation statute to conserve water to select the priority date of the water that will be transferred that is saved. And it also allows for water conservation projects to be reviewed and to go through this process, even though they may have already been completed. Basically, that's what the bill does, and we're asking for a change in the sunset date. It was to be sunsetted December 1999, and we're asking for that date to be extended until July 1st, year 2003.
Tom, what's your go-ahead?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Byler with the Water Resources Department. Before you, we've handed out some testimony from the department that explains the nuances of the program, but as Jan mentioned, this basically would extend two temporary provisions in the Conserved Water Program. The Conserved Water Program is one a good example of a program that our agency has that really provides a win-win situation for both the water users and the resource the health of the watershed by providing new water supplies through greater through efficiency efforts for the water user, as well as providing for in-stream, increasing in-stream flows. We support this idea, and we think it will help provide an incentive for more use of the program.
Okay, question three. Nothing? Dee, Thomas, go ahead.
Chairman, members of the committee, Dee Bridges, Oregon Water Association. I only wanted to add my support to the bill.
Okay. Yes. Any questions from the committee? Hearing none? I guess not. So we're going to go into work session on Senate Bill 1098. Do I hear a...
Mr. Chair, is that the good amendment?
Yep.
Move 1098 to forward, keep that recommendation.
Senator Corcoran moves 1098 to forward, keep that recommendation. Any discussion, any objections? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair, aye. Senator Bill 1098 passes forward, keep that recommendation. Are there any gentlemen want to say this thing? Close the work session on 1098. What do you have next on the page for?
So we've got 1187.
I want to do a brief work session on 1187. I understand there are some concerns about maybe some amendments on this issue. Open the public hearing on 1187. Mr. Schmidt. We're going to decide to say the name is not that bad noise.
No.
Oh,
no.
We can pull that board.
I think Mr. Curry should do that. His role is the Oregon Water Division.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Curry, would you come up here, please?
I wonder. Mr. Lindy looks more Indian than he does. He's got more hair.
No, be careful that you get into serious thoughts, you're going to come and shoot you.
Okay, good.
You've already been a victim.
Jerry, we have opened the public hearing on 1187. Why don't you go ahead and lead off on this, if you would.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt, here today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. With me is Matt Farmer, staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I'll do a brief introduction and I'll let legal counsel take over because he's had a lot more familiarity with these laws both from our association standpoint and with local government. So I just want to give you a brief premise. In the handout I gave you, was my commentary that I'm making to you now. In fact, I'm not going to make the whole thing. I'm just going to give you a brief overview. And then on the back page is the bill with a hand and growth portion. We did submit a dash one amendment because of the concerns with local governments, particularly the AOC, who were concerned that we didn't specify in the bill what we were trying to do, and that was reach the issue surrounding Goal 14. We did make an amendment to do that. I think we will further need another amendment just to clarify the language. And the way the language is that we did in the hand and growth portion is to have it read, exceptions taken from goals protecting farmland and forest land shall not be subject to Goal 14. And that's how we wanted it to read. And that's the intent of the bill, and the intent of the amendments is to reflect that wording. The issue comes back from the 1980s when the now famous Curry County case was reached the state Supreme Court. The issue there was that the county adopted the exception areas. So they went out and identified them and said, well, these areas don't fit our definitions. We're going to use the exceptions process. They did that. They identified them. The LCD said, yes, we like those. That appears that this meets the intent of our statutes, the intent of our laws. It goes all the way through, and then it runs into the appeals process, and they said during the appeals process, well, you identified the exceptions, and you identified that, in fact, you met all these criteria, but you didn't take an exception to Goal 14. Well, Goal 14 deals with urban boundaries and urban uses. And the extent of that appeal in the 76-page court opinion has rendered that process almost unworkable. So what we're attempting to do in this amendment is to clarify the process, eliminate the redundancy, because we're going through and establishing a process where these resource lands that are clearly identifiable under the statute as exceptions lands then don't have to be re-gone through with the process under Goal 14. I want to stress two or three points what the bill does. First of all, it simplifies the process, allows the exception process is sufficient because it tells the applicants you have to go through all these procedures in order to get an exception. It eliminates the redundancy. It still subjects the exceptions lands to all the requirements of the goals. I mean, you still have to do that when you're going through the exceptions process. It recognizes on certain lands, resource use is not possible or practicable. So what we're saying is that this is a process that clearly is set out in law, and what we're trying to do is allow the bill to work, allow the process to work. What it doesn't do, it doesn't lead to uncontrolled growth, because you clearly have to identify with the regulatory requirements. A local government can restrict a non-resource area by authorizing a zoning requirement. So, in other words, you don't build hotels out there in rural lands or unfettered growth if, in fact, the local government regulates that activity and says, here's what you can do. We want to make sure that this doesn't authorize a use, and then clearly if you need an exception, it doesn't say that you can do anything you want to. You still have to meet all the requirements set down through the planning process. And clearly, in closing, I want to say that it doesn't interfere with the use of other resource lands, like right to farm and that kind of thing. So I want to turn it over to legal counsel to give you just a better summation of what some of the legal parameters are in this law. With that, Matt, go ahead and
put
the name of your record.
Yeah. Senator Tarnow, Chairman Tarnow, and members of the committee, Matt Farmer, staff attorney for Oregon Association of Realtors. I think you'll see as soon as we get up from here a herd of technical doomsayers, and there will be no end of guys falling testimony. When you hear that, keep a couple of things in mind. Senate Bill 100 that started this process said local governments who know their areas and are in touch with the needs of the people ought to plan for the use of land. And that to keep that from getting out of control, the state ought to have some goals and policies and guidelines that ought to go along with that and set those forth and did what I think was a good job of setting forth those kinds of overarching concerns at the state level, all the time remembering that it was the local people who understood their needs. As part of that process of goal making, it was realized that there are a lot of things on the ground out there that don't necessarily meet the new direction, and that those things must be accounted for. And so one of the goals allowed for exceptions to the other goals. And it didn't allow for exceptions just because you might want them. It set up some criteria saying something is here that ought to be here or is already here or needs to be accounted for or dealt with, and it meets other economic and social concerns and is compatible with surrounding uses and so on. Those things are right in the criteria, and they continue to be right in the criteria. Prior to the Curry County case in the late 1980s, no one imagined, including LPDC, that Goal 14, which is intended to control growth around incorporated urban areas and to keep them from spreading in an uncontrolled manner, applied to rural land.
Mr. Palmer, let me interject just a thought. I recall, I think, this is a Curry County case wherein Curry County and LCDC agreed.
That's exactly
on
right.
The usage and Thousand Friends files against LCDC and Curry County.
That's true.
And they prevailed.
At the Supreme Court level, but not at the Court of Appeals. So prior to this case, LCDC
court level and not at the court.
Not at the Court of Appeals. So what happened was Curry
County... And that's just confused us up here because you used the Supreme Court first and then you went back to the Court of Appeals. So.
Let me see if I can straighten that up for you, Mr. Chairman. Curry County took a number of exceptions, and LCDC, as part of their acknowledgement duties, acknowledged those exceptions as consistent with the planning goal, is consistent with Oregon law. At that point, 1,000 Friends sued them. Of course, that suit would go first to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals upheld LCDC's decision and Curry County's decision. They then appealed to the Supreme Court, and it was the Supreme Court that reversed and said, well, even though you did take an exception to Goals 3 and 4 and met all those criteria, you did not take an exception to Goal 14, the urbanization goal, and therefore you have to do it all over again. The problem there, and the one that we would like to address, is that there is no practical way to meet Goal 14 in a rural area because Goal 14 is written for urban growth boundary uses. And in order to meet that criteria outside the urban growth boundary, you have to show that there is no use out there for that land other than urban uses. And, of course, you can't do that because what's the most common allowed use of rural areas? None. It sits there. It's open space. And so you can always have that use, and so you can never show that you can't use it for anything else. What Curry County did, what LCDC approved of at that point, what the Court of Appeals upheld, was that once you have these exceptions, you ought to be able to have reasonable uses that meet the criteria, that are compatible, and so on. And so that's really our point, is that we ought to be able to have local government, counties, now we're talking about rural land, counties decide what kinds of uses are compatible in those zones. They can't build anything they want there because they still have these exception criteria to meet. And so we don't think the effect would be anything other than to allow the decision making to go back to local people. We think that's important for this reason. Since this time, LCDC has become very involved in planning rules for rural communities. Now, why is that kind of planning being done at a state level? Why aren't counties planning for their rural communities? The reason is that those rural communities are in exceptions areas. They have uses that densities above that that the Curry County decision allows, and therefore they cannot zone them, basically, cannot plan at the local level. That burden has shifted up to the state. Rural services, sewers, waters, and so on, you will see LCDC now at the state level very involved in what local government ought to be doing about rural services, whether they're existing or planned or what. And so you have to ask yourself, why have these decisions, after Senate Bill 100 said, we're going to kind of give you some guidelines and let you do it, why are these decisions now up at the state level? And is that the proper place for them? And that's really the issues that we'd like to address. Thanks, Dave.
No, thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Well, Mr. Rindy and Mr. Schellenberg, why don't you both come at the same time?
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Bindy. I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Let me start off to indicate that the testimony I just handed to you was written without having seen the handwritten version. And so what my testimony talks about is why should we exempt all the planning requirements statewide for areas that are exception areas to goals 3 and 4. Since I wrote this, of course, the bill has changed, and it's now talking about goal 14 only, or at least that's the proposed amendments that you just heard. I think I'm going to tell you a whole different story than you just heard. Maybe people can disagree, but first of all, the Curry County case. In the Curry County case, the principle of the case was whether or not when an exception was taken to goal 3 or 4, whether a county had to apply other land use goals. In fact, the case was about the principle of this bill as it was originally written. You only have, once you take an exception, are you then exempt? What the court declared, the Supreme Court, in their 1986 opinion, was that the county has to apply goal 14. They have to show that they meet goal 14. There are many ways to show that you meet goal 14, and if you go through all of those and find you don't, then in the very end, you may take an exception. So the first thing I'd like to correct from what we just heard, the court did not tell counties to take another exception. The court told counties to make sure, and this doesn't happen until peer review, when they come back for replanning 10, 15 years later on their plan, they have to revisit and make sure that they can meet goal 14. And most counties show that the planning they did locally for rural exception areas do meet goal 14. The cases that the main reason the counties don't meet goal 14 is they, as you heard, if urban uses are authorized in rural areas. Unlike what you just heard, anything other than open space is not automatically an urban use, and there's no court that's ever declared that. Obviously, everybody can disagree as to when you cross the line between rural or urban. But most of the case law on this find that crossing that line typically involves a fairly intense use. For example, a proposed stadium and rock concert hall in the rural area of Yamhill County about 7 or 8 years ago was declared to be an urban use by LUBA. In general, what Goal 14 is seeking to do is to make sure that in the general scheme of planning in Oregon, inside urban growth boundaries, we want to have intensive urban uses with urban services, sewer, water, and intense development. Outside of urban growth boundaries, we're primarily trying to preserve land for farm and forest use, but recognize there are many, many areas, 750,000 acres, that were already in some way developed. Most of those areas are not automatically in violation of Goal 14. The problem is that, and the Curry County is an example of this, the zoning applied to those areas in some cases had no limits as to the intensity of use uses authorized. So in Curry County, the density authorized for exception areas that the court was speaking to was far higher, and I'm sorry I don't recall the numbers, but I think it was it was 7,000 or 5,000 square foot lots in the area that today are 5 and 10 acre lots. And that's what the court was speaking to. The court didn't rule that that density was urban. The court simply ruled that LCDC have to, on a case-by-case basis, or if they wished they could do rules, they have to make up their mind what is urban, and LCDC has declined to do that. LCDC instead has continued to urge counties to come forward individually on a case-by-case basis and try to show locally why in a particular county they meet Goal 14. That way we don't have a one-size-fits-all state rule. And so we have so far spent a long time trying to stay in that position. Recently we've approached counties about coming up with a safe harbor, something that says you don't have to do it this way, but if you do it this way, you know you're home free. You can try some other way. But we don't have a statewide goal on Goal 14, with the exception of the rural communities that you just heard about. Why did we do a rule for rural communities? Counties came forward and petitioned LCDC, asking LCDC to do a rural communities rule. We did so hand-in-hand with counties. One of the most successful rule-making exercises I've been involved with, counties, other parties, very praising of that exercise. The exercise authorizes counties to locally plan rural communities and basically allows very intensive uses in the 600 unincorporated communities throughout Oregon. Totally optional. Counties don't have to plan those communities any different than they are now, but they may under the rules that we proposed. So finally, we, at the request of Metro and some others, LCDC, about 5 years ago, adopted rules for urban reserves. Those are based on Goal 14. If you pass the bill the way it's proposed to be amended and remove Goal 14 from urban reserve from exception areas, or excuse me, if you require the exception areas no longer have to meet Goal 14, that would have the effect of undoing all the urban reserve planning that Metro just completed 4 or 5 years worth of planning they're still in the middle of. Because that entire rule is based on Goal 14. Our rural communities rule is based on Goal 14. That is also, all rural communities are exception areas as described by the rule. So I don't want to, as the previous speaker talked about, give you horror stories, but I don't know what it would mean if we were to take Goal 14 away when it is the only underpinning of two of our most recent exercises where we have provided some guidance to counties for rural communities and urban reserves. I think the main effect of taking away Goal 14 for exception areas is that some very intensive uses that today Goal 14 prohibits, very intensive meaning, for example, industry or highly intensive commercial uses that are now not allowed except under an exception in the outside of urban growth boundaries, those could be built. We could start to see Costco's or rock stadiums or other things out in farm areas. And today, the only way you can build those is if you take an exception to Goal 14. I'll stop and be happy to answer any questions.
I said Don, talk first, and then we'll see the questions on both of you guys.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schoenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. The only thing I guess I would say, or the most succinct thing I would say, is the summary. I think this says it all. Exempts land for which exception is taken from land use planning goals protecting farmland and forest land from any other land use planning goal. Well, in this case, it would be from Goal 14 land use planning goals if it were amended, as Mr. Schmidt indicated. But that is of great concern to us. You just heard Mr. Rindy talk about the ramifications of that. If that kind of development is allowed in the EFU, well, where are exception areas? They're out in the EFU zones, largely. And if you allow a high level of development on those exception areas out there, then you drastically increase the traffic. I'm thinking of out my way, Highway 22. Used to be a fairly benign highway till the casino came in. Now you've got what is essentially a Goal 14 use out there, and now you got a packed highway and accidentally, you won't believe, and you know, I have to wait a long time. I live out there. I have to make a left-hand turn to get onto the highway to come to work. Boy, that's dangerous. And so that's the kind of thing that, if this bill were to proceed, would occur that could occur. I'm not saying it would necessarily. It depends where you're at and who wants to do what, but that's the kind of thing that could occur in many places around the state.
Don, you and Bob both have fired in down to Brookings, Gold Beach, and Curry County and seen the coastline they were talking about. There's very little, if any, prime farmland that could fall on a floodplain. You know, so we can rule out, I think, putting any kind of a dwelling in prime farmland. And granted, maybe there is some pretty good timber area down here. I know that there is further inland from the coastline because you don't have those scrubby coastal pines taking over control of the growth. But the point of the issue, Bob, you and I talked about before, but can we change or look at our laws from a regionalized perspective? You know, we've got a coastline in Oregon where it's hard to find good prime farmland, and though that farmland is there, is very valuable. And plus, it also floods, and the reason why it is good is because it brings in silt. Every time it floods, it enhances the soil conditions there. But it's kind of frustrating when you've got a case like we have in Gold Beach, and you want to expand a little bit, and LCDC joined with the county, and then it got shot down. So I don't know where we're going to go with this. I appreciate your testimony, and I sent you a short conditional amendments and bring it back to us, and you guys have a chance to talk to him. I appreciate it. Any questions for you two folks? So I thank you very much.
Chairman.
Appreciate it. And Mr. Kohlmeyer, Mike?
Chair Tarnow and members of the committee, I have turned in written testimony prepared by Charles Lindell, the staff attorney at Thousand Friends of Oregon. This testimony was also prepared before the author of the testimony was aware of any amendments, but Thousand Friends of Oregon would still be in opposition to this bill, even if it is cut back to address only Goal 14.
Okay. Well, I thank you for being so short. That's not like you. Something wrong? You check. You feel okay?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Mr. Phelps.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Murray Phelps representing Metro. We would like to be part of the process to develop a new set of amendments. In the present form, we have to oppose the bill merely from the perspective of all the planning we've done on the urban reserves that Mr. Rindy talked about, plus the fact the expansion of the urban growth boundary went into, we had to pick up about 5,000 acres and only 800 of it had to go into farmland. The others went into the exception areas of the non-farmland. So this would cause a...
Within areas?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But we'd like to be part of the solution. We don't want to be a problem.
And perhaps you'd be so kind to talk to Mr. Schmidt and Matt back there and see about how we can't figure out something on this one. Question, Mr. Schmidt?
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1187. And if we can't, time, we got one more week to work on the bills, and then bring it back to you again.
Why only one more week?
It's just
going out of here. And then what are we going to do from May to June to then?
Let you go to the sauna if you want to.
The sauna in the summer. Now that makes it, you must be some...
I think you might need it.
The only place they need sauna in the summer.
And it probably do you some good. Okay, we'll take Senate Bill 1189. Ask Mr. Ledger, Mr. is it Hardison, Higginson, and Mark Yeager.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, put him in there.
Is Mr. Yeager here? Well, it's tough. Okay.
Oh, not too good. Huh? You said Mr. Yeager has a light?
Yes. Mr. Ledger, make a short speech point to think.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good evening. I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries. And I have with me Don Higginson with Cable Houston, Benedict and Higginson. He's an attorney who works with AOI and is chairman of our permitting committee. We're here today to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 1189. The reason we're here is because there's a problem that's been popping up in this state and other states that has to do with lawsuits. And if one of you, for instance, operated a facility or a municipal discharge plant, and you found out that you were violating the standards and you went and talked to the DEQ, that you would be put on a consent order, sign a consent order, whereby you agreed to come into compliance. And very often that involves some construction. So it might take 2 or 3 or 5 years for you to come into compliance. You would sign a consent order with DEQ, and you would probably pay a penalty, and you'd think everything was fine and going forward. But what can happen and what is happening is that under the Clean Water Act, you can have a civil or a citizen lawsuit filed against you, even though you are on a consent order and have paid a penalty, and they will file a citizen lawsuit against you, and you may be liable for penalties of up to $25,000 a day. There's no shield for you. Plus, you've already probably admitted in your consent order that you were violating. So it's pretty much an open and shut case. And what happens is cities or facilities, Smith Frozen Foods was one, I think City Torrance was another, essentially are forced to settle out of court for a large amount of cash because it's not, they don't have a very strong case. And what this does, of course, is this drains money out of the system, out of the cities, out of the facilities, and it also makes companies and cities very hesitant to come to DEQ and identify that they have a problem, because even though they get on consent order, they can still be sued. It's a bad situation. I do have a handout that passed out. What this bill does is establish an alternative pathway that is allowed under the Federal Clean Water Act. Right now, when you enter into negotiations with the DEQ, if you have a violation, they are essentially private negotiations. The DEQ finds you're violating, you sit down with DEQ and you negotiate a consent order and you negotiate a fine. And if you look at this tan-colored flowchart I gave you, that's just one box on, it would be the left as you're looking at it. And that's the existing system. Under that system, you have no shield from citizen suits. The public is not involved in the negotiation of the consent order. Sign a consent order, you can still be sued. Under this proposal, which is allowed under the Clean Water Act, it puts your, if you want to, puts your consent order out to a public review process, similar to a rulemaking. And that is, the consent order gets drafted up by DEQ and goes out to public comment. And the public comments received back by DEQ, and the DEQ has an option. They can either issue the order and penalty as it was written, or they can modify it. And there's a series of events after that. They notify the parties again, and there may be a hearing requested. If so, then there's a formal hearing. Everybody's notified. And ultimately, the DEQ makes a decision based on public comments and comments by the company and issues the final order. You get to the same place. But there's quite a bit of public involvement. The benefit of this is that the company or the municipality has a defense against citizen suits because it's already been through a public process. Now, many companies, especially in some municipalities, will say, we don't want to go through this process. We feel comfortable just going through the old process. They still can. However, if they want to, they can go through this public involvement process. And their consent order goes out to a lot of public review, which, you know, they may not like, but it's part of the process. And as a result of that, they do get some protection from citizen suits. I do have some testimony from Mr. Yeager, who had to leave. Mr. Yeager was one of the co-requesters for his association. The Association of Clean Water Agencies was a co-requester on this bill. That association is made up of about 75 municipal and private treatment works. And of course, they're very concerned about citizen suits. Mr. Yeager works for the City of Albany, and I'll just submit his testimony if I could. We did go through an extensive series of meetings with the DEQ on this bill. We had a meeting where the environmental activist community was invited. Only one organization showed up, represented by a lawyer who makes his living filing citizen suits. He had two suggestions on the bill, one of which we took, the other which we did not, which was don't go in the bill. But we have changed this quite a bit over the 6 months or a year that we've been working on it. There are some amendments that you should have.
do not have copies.
We have dash ones, John.
We have the dash ones. Right. And the amendments, which were prepared in cooperation with legislative counsel, clarify a couple of things. One is when the, since they're all timelines associated with this process, 20 days to do this, 15 days, so they define when enforcement begins, just so we all know what is day one. And there's also the second part of the amendment, section 9 on the amendment, starting on page 13, which says that the process that we're using here is comparable or comparable to the federal process. And it needs to be comparable to the federal process to get that shield. One thing that we did, that did get adopted into the amendments that we really, that we didn't ask for, and we in discussions with DEQ, we would think would be a benefit to cut would be the very last section of the amendment. Mm-hmm. The last sentence, excuse me, of the amendment. We don't think that really adds anything to it, and it would, and DEQ would like to see it out. We have no objection to that. So with that, I'll conclude, and I have Mr. Hagerson here to answer any legal questions.
I guess I'd like some sense of how big the problem is, not so much from the Clean Water Agency side, but from the AOI side, because I'm hoping that you'd be able to pay for those lawsuits through the savings to get accrued to 1149. But anyway, give me a sense of how severe the problem is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cochran, I think it's a right now it's a moderately severe problem that is going to get much worse. We've had a couple of suits, Smith's Frozen Foods, Knee Deep Cattle Company. One of the things that happens when a lawsuit like this develops is it sucks everybody into it, including the DEQ. We start getting into discovery and depositions, and it just drives up enormous costs and enormous DEQ time also. So we believe this is a serious problem.
So did you handle the Smith Frozen Foods case?
Chair Tarno, Senator Cochran, no, I didn't. I've talked to the attorney who did over at the Miller Nash Law Firm about that case, and I reviewed that case, and I reviewed the Needy Cattle case, which is one that also came out of Oregon. I'm familiar with it. There's a City of Florence case, and there have been some other ones besides that, too, where these suits have been threatened, where you've gone through a state enforcement process, and then someone comes in to the people and said, look, you've just signed a consent order with a state that more or less admits that you had this violation. I'm going to go to federal court with you and get a bunch of civil penalties against you unless you work something out with me here. And do you want to go to federal court or you want to work something out with me? So it's been used in that way, too, to create leverage.
For the record, your name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Don Hagerson.
Thanks, Don. Mr. Hagerson, so just following that up, I don't understand. I guess this is a honest question. I don't understand why the very act of signing the consent order with DEQ doesn't act as a barrier to lawsuits.
Chair Tarno, Senator Cochran, early on we'd hoped that it would. The federal statute, the Clean Water Act, has some very specific language in it about when this shield is created. And it says the law has to be comparable to the federal law, and the federal law has kind of this flow chart that John is presented in it. And Needy Cattle came out of Oregon, out of a consent order, and it went to the district court, and it went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they said that wasn't comparable. In that case, a civil penalty had not been paid, but there was also discussion about Oregon's process of notice and comment and right to hearing and right to judicial review wasn't comparable to the federal law. And then the Smith Foods came after that and followed on to Needy Cattle and said essentially the same thing, that Oregon's program, the way it's set up, doesn't have enough notice and comment, enough right to hearing, and a right to judicial review by interested parties. So that's why we've done this. You know, we've gotten zapped on it at least two times on that specific issue, and we think it's time to change it, because the law does allow it, the federal law does allow it. It's just a question of what you have to do in Oregon, and we think this does it.
Why are you saying then that what this does is this constructs the public notice mechanism that would satisfy the feds if a lawsuit was brought, then a federal suit was brought, like in the case of Smith Foods, if we had had this process in place and there was these continuing violations? I wasn't aware in the Smith Foods case that Smith Foods took any affirmative move to correct the problem. I thought they said they corrected their problem, and then it was determined that they hadn't.
Chair Tarnow, Senator Cochran, there is a long history with the Smith Foods case, but eventually Smith Foods sat down with the department and developed a MAO, it was called, a mutual agreement and orders that resolved the issue and put them on a schedule to bring them to a position where the Department of Environmental Quality was satisfied with what they were doing. And then the suit was filed in federal court. And if this process had been available at that time and they had gone through that and with the department agreed on or resolved what steps they had to take to be in full compliance, then this process would have created a shield and there would have been no federal suit, or there would have been a bar to the federal suit.
But Mr. Higginson, there wouldn't have been a shield if in the monitoring of the agreement there had been a continuing violation that was outside the order that was signed. Is that correct?
Chair Tarnow, Senator Cochran, yes, that's correct. Okay. The shield only covers what's covered with the state in its enforcement proceeding. So if there are a series of violations that are wrapped up and then there's a compliance schedule to come back into compliance, whatever is covered by that enforcement action with the state is what the shield is for. And one other point that I'd like to add here is the people who went to federal court in Smith Foods, if this process were used at the state level, those people wouldn't be out in the dark. There would be the right for them, and what this creates is a right for them to come into the state process. What it's doing is, instead of two processes, it's combining it into one. Right now, there's a question about what their rights are in the state process, but they certainly don't have the right to request a hearing, they don't have the right to judicial review. This would give them those rights. So you take those parties, you bring them into the state process, and you only have to do this once.
Okay.
Good questions.
I might also add, Mr. Chairman, committee members, we did talk with D2 today, and we got some sort of last-minute, I think fairly minor concerns that we're still working on, but I don't think they may come to nothing if they come to something that is fairly small.
Well, we'll ask him in a few moments, then, John.
We would be happy to bring it back from the other side.
Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Catherine?
Chair Tarnow, committee members, Catherine Tomatic, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. To be brief, I want to add the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association's support of Senate Bill 1189 with the -1 amendment. The Northwest Pulp and Paper Association is aware of this issue, although it has not affected a pulp and paper member in Oregon. We also do operate in Washington, and this is also an issue of concern in the state of Washington. So we would support this remedy in a legislative form.
Catherine, thank you. Take a look at the last sentence in the -1, too, if you will. Senator George.
Catherine, are there other states that have a process that's similar to this, as, you know, a two-avenue approach?
Chair Connell, Senator George, I cannot answer that question. I don't know whether other states have adopted such a process as we are proposing here. But I could find that out for you.
You would think that there would be one because of the federal remedy set up one the EPA that gave an exemption. It seemed like there would have been some sort of form that you would have had to follow her to meet that.
Chair Tarnow, may I call in reinforcements to help you with that answer?
No, I think you're coming forth.
Thank you.
Chair Tarnow, Senator George, the issue has actually been litigated in quite a number of states, and there are some cases where the courts have determined that what the state has in effect is comparable to federal law, and therefore the shield arises and protects people who have gone through a state enforcement process. And then there's other decisions like the ones that have come out of Oregon, and there's also one out of Washington, where the courts have determined that the process is not comparable, and so it doesn't create the shield. So there are states that have programs similar to what we're talking about here, where it creates a comparable process for state enforcement, so there would be a protection against a federal court suit.
So then the pathway that's set up under 1189 would in fact follow the pathway that has been in the cases that have ruled that this is appropriate process. In other words, this is meeting what the decisions have said is an appropriate process that will provide the exemption.
Chair Tarno, Senator George, yes. It is follows it incorporates those cases as well as everything that's in the Clean Water Act statute itself. We started with the statute itself, and then we went through the cases to make sure that there wasn't some part of the process that we were missing, to try to make this as all-encompassing as possible, so the next time that somebody does go to court, they won't say, well, you left this step out.
So then this would be a model, then, of what would be an appropriate process.
Yeah.
It should keep us right within the... Okay.
And again, Don, your name for record, please.
Oh, Don Hagen.
Thank you. Okay. Jim?
Chair Tarno, you were asking me a question about the Dash 1 amendment.
Yeah, just take a look at the last sentence in the Dash 1, and maybe you have a conversation with John and Don at some point in time about that. We'll bring it back, Catherine Williams.
Well, we would support the conceptual amendment to the Dash 1 amendment dated 4/14/99 starting on line 16, striking the second the, and continuing striking line 17 and 18. We would support that.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Okay. Roy and Les, Carlo, is that right? That we've got to shut down the hearing because there's a fisherman in here.
Some person knows this whole thing.
Lori, go please.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lori Onan, Department of Environmental Quality. And with me is Les Carlo. We're here to say that we do support this bill, the concept of this bill. As you've heard earlier testimony, there are some minor things we want to make sure are clear in the bill, so we're going to continue to talk with them and make sure that the language actually is clear about what, so that there's no confusion about what the intent is and that it's clear to everybody how this process works. But we do believe that it is minor and can be worked out.
Sure.
Les Carlo will have a couple more additional comments just to cover a couple other issues we wanted to alert you to.
Mr. Carlo, go ahead.
Chair Tarno, members of the committee. My name is Les Carlo. I'm the enforcement manager for the Department of Environmental Quality. There isn't very much I wanted to bring up. I just wanted to alert you to one aspect of this bill, and that is that we can't guarantee that this will actually create a bar to the citizen suit in any particular case. And the reason for that is that it's an optional process that we're creating here upon election by the facility, and that's not an aspect of the federal Clean Water Act.
Chair Cooper?
Yes. Are you familiar with the Smith Food case? Were you involved?
No, I was not.
Is there anybody at the agency that was?
There, yes.
George,
Senate Bill 1189 is the optional pathway. I don't know if you've seen the thing they prepared for it. Would that, in fact, fit the federal model? In other words, what I hear you saying is that's probably a good model, except the fact that we have another process that you might go through. It seems like once you chose that pathway, they should honor that, but I know there's probably some technicalities and decisions and rulings that have occurred. What can you tell us? Is there a federal model that this was prepared for?
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I'll start to answer that question, then Les might want to amplify what I say. The issue is that because the federal law does not provide the two options, the federal law says here's the way that the process works with the citizen shield, here's how you get it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just laying out this is the process. It doesn't have, well, the facility can choose the process. So what we're saying is we don't know how a court would interpret Senate Bill 1189 if it were, if somebody brought a suit and said, this doesn't quite match or is not comparable to the federal law. We don't know for sure what a court would do, but we think that we support the option approach, but we just don't know what a court would do.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on Federal 1189, and Mr. Ledger, I assume you'll be back in contact with us in the near future on some Dash 2. Okay. We're going to open the public hearing on is this a public hearing and possible?
Yes.
Public hearing and possible on Senate Bill 1258, and ask Representative Thompson if he has a couple of comments on it.
Oh my gosh. I thought you said most of the testimony was going to be sent tonight.
Just turn off the mic.
Representative Terry Thompson, District 4. Let me give you a little background on what's going to happen and what has happened on the Oregon coast, because these structures are very controversial down there. And after 1977, if you were grandfathered in, if you had a riprap along the Oregon coast. And there are several people, because erosions, El Ninos, and changes in the ocean condition, which tend to make these important to protecting your property, or you think. But what happens with a lot of these structures is you protect your property, but your neighbor a lot of times is eroded away from because of the protection you've created on your property. The governor's taken a policy, as if you're not aware of, there in the Tillamook area, when those homes were built, not to allow these structures. There is a problem, though, that is going to exist, and it's right there in my area, and below Otter Rock, where the highway is slipping into the ocean. And it's going to require either a riprap or a moving of the highway. That decision hasn't been made yet, but it's going to be very expensive in either case. The road is now eroding away right up to what you would call the outside white fog line, and it's caving away at 6 inches a year. Well, it doesn't take long before you realize we're going to have a major problem. That is one. This bill doesn't distinctly address that issue, but it's an issue you want to keep in mind when you start saying, no, we don't want to change the policy, or yes, we do. It's a policy that has to be dealt with. As it is, I am opposed to the bill. I think that we need some flexibility, but this is an outright repeal of it. That worries me, because I know that we've worked hard to get to the situation where we are. And if we start riprapping up and down along the whole coast, there is going to be a movement and beach erosion. So that's my statement, and I'll be glad to answer any question I can.
Senator Thompson, you're as DMV or ODOT on this.
Senator Thompson, you've already accepted the fact. I haven't even said I'd run you.
I haven't started working on it. Seems like you're going to be a
hard to get out of here. Where is ODOT on this issue? Let me try that again.
Martin, where is ODOT on this issue? Well, I can only say in the one section, like say south of Otter Rock, is they think it's the logical alternative to go in and put a mat behind it and then put riprap up against that edge at this point. But the other alternative of moving the road hasn't been thoroughly analyzed yet. There is an old road bed inside. But it's a tremendously geological sensitive area that's sliding away in several places. And the Army Corps of Engineers has come in and looked at it, too. There's been talk of an outside Otter Rock. They're looking at any option available, I think, at this time.
Terry, is there a bridge nearby there?
Yes, there's a bridge that's deteriorated and needs to be replaced. Oregon Shores Coalition, because of the riprapping around the edge of the bridge, has said they didn't want to do it. I'm worried that that bridge is in such poor shape that it could be a catastrophe, and they've blocked them. Not everything. I think we need to get on with improving that road and make the decision and go forward.
Questions? Any quick questions?
I take it from your testimony then, Representative, that your concern is that this bill is too broad, but we should provide some latitude for like public roads so that we don't interfere with transportation needs there, but still not get into pitting neighbor against neighbor by the erosion that would be caused by the riprap.
You got exactly it. I think there are situations that exist on the coast where it becomes a necessity to take a blanket policy either for or against. I think doesn't bring into account the situations that develop up and down along the coast. And I know every district is different. I know that the Senator Tarno's district has a problem there. South of Port Orford, it's mind-boggling, the amount of sliding. I'm not sure it's at the riprap situation, but each of those, you need to have that flexibility, the ability to use it. I wouldn't want to see a no riprap or a you can riprap anywhere policy. Each one has to be looked at individually.
Okay. Anybody else?
Thank you. Representative, one of the issues, you know, if you turn to the second page of the bill and you look down the line 16 on, what you see here is the person who requested the bill, we allowed him to draft the bill, was very much concerned about the fact that we've been allowing riprap, the very, very lax standards of how the structure is placed, how it's constructed, what kind of engineering, for the quality of the engineering. He attempted to address that in here, and literally what I believe was in his mind was that we bring out one more time the idea that we do have issues like Mulock Beach, and we do have issues in which state highways are literally moving towards the ocean, and that area of Mulock Beach settled 13 inches one night. In fact, where I was down there recently, talked with a state trooper who said that he does not, when he has an emergency run out to the north, he approaches that at under 25 miles an hour. Because he's so worried that during the period of time, the last time he was through that thing could have slid down that much. So it's an issue that needs to be addressed, and the bill is more or less a pushing, let's make a decision on this. There's some emergency situations developing. There is a problem, too, and I think he was attempting to address that, and I have gone down and photographed some of it here, in which, depending on what time your house was built, you have a right to come in and put up riprap structure. But if I have a newer home, I can't. And so literally, under existing law, we can't have a uniform application of riprap. So you go ahead and do it because you have an old right, but I have a new right. So you're literally directing your erosion onto me, but I have no right to have protection. So it's an issue we need to look at. I don't know if we'll get clearer through it this time, but we do need to keep a constant focus on what's the balance here.
Can I make one brief comment, and then I'll let you guys go, because I know the hour's late. And Senator George is right, but it's not by the house structure. I believe it's by if you had to have a pre-existing riprap before 1977. And it does create problems sometimes with erosion next to it. And the bill, I appreciate the fact that you brought the bill forward, because anytime we can highlight this issue and have the conversation, I think we need to. Beach erosion is real. Problem, and I don't like to see riprap jobs, but I'm afraid there are certain circumstances that I think it becomes imperative that we have to do for the public welfare.
Sure, for 1 second, you wouldn't suggest we turn down that jetty, though, at a reunion, too.
I was hoping you would say
that. That was exactly what
I was trying to quiz you about the situation of jetties up and down. Jetties are jetties, but they are riprap rock, which is essential to the economy of the state of Oregon. And that is one of the situations where I think that it's essential that we keep these riprap projects.
Sorry about that.
No,
Question or comment?
Just no comment. I don't think that it does any good to talk about it. I said, my dad says, just flap your jaws. I think we should do something about it. Let's get a bill that somebody can accept and move forward, because there's been a lot of talking for a long time, and it doesn't seem like anything's getting done.
That's a prior statement.
I would like to see some clear definitions, because I know the train wreck is coming on aircraft on the hill.
Sure, thank you.
If I could really quickly, in response to Senator Shannon, that was exactly what was thought in this. There was an amendment was proposed to have it specific to the state highway that said this is the acceptable process, but then also at the same time specifying that there had to be quality work done in doing the riprap. We just can't have somebody jumping rock over the edge. It needs to be properly placed and fitted into the appearance of the coast. So there was constructivity to that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice seeing you, Senator.
Take the night off, Representative. Mr. Rindy. Got a few minutes here.
So you'll get in trouble with your cup.
Sure. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and for a couple of reasons, I'm not going to read this testimony. It is late, and number one, our coastal hazards coordinator was unable to be here tonight, and I don't want to reveal that, although I did get a crash course, I'm not going to be able to answer all your questions on this. I do want to point out the second half of page two, for a quick summary, the land use program on the coast is a part of the Oregon Coastal Management Program, and that is a part of a federal program. LCDC adopted coastal goals in part to comply with federal requirements, and those were incorporated into that federal program as part of that. If a change of this magnitude to the coastal program is adopted, we will have to approach the feds and make also changes that are right there. So that is the reason for the fiscal impact that we've identified. There is going to be a lot of work, as there was in just establishing our relationship and agreement with the federal government in order to reestablish it. To summarize the gist of the letter, I think this approach does go too far. There are processes whereby requirements of the state can be waived through the exceptions process. If that is something that someone wants to move away from, I think there are ways to do it that are much better than simply waiving the requirements as this bill would do. So we would hope that you consider that and take questions at this point.
What goals are about 17 and 18?
Actually, goals 17 and 18, but also possibly goals 16 are affected as well.
Okay. Questions, Rudy? Bob, you're right. This is great. Thank you very much.
I'm going
to set this up in the fire beaches.
Fire beaches? Sure. So they can control them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cleary, Director of the Division of State Lands. Don't have any prepared remarks, but I think that what we're looking at here is trying to strike a balance between protecting public interest and individual property rights. The tools that we've got right now are a combination of both the land use laws and the permitting process, in our case, the removal fill permitting process, and then the Department of Parks beach permitting process. In 1977, they adopted Goal 18, and they said that if you had a lot that was platted and developed, and the way they defined developed was if you had utilities extended out to it, didn't have to have the buildings on it, you could qualify for a beachfront protected structure. After that date, the intent was to use the land use planning process to ensure that we appropriately buffered new developments away from the hazards of the coast. In other words, use land use planning and zoning to keep people from pushing too close to the edge. And therefore, we never thought we'd have to issue beachfront protected structures for those new developments. Unfortunately, we've had some experiences with some that did find a way to push close to the edge, and one of them is the Case development up at Oceanside. And right now, you've got a lawsuit going on between the homeowners and the developers, where the homeowners are saying, we wish you hadn't pushed so close to the edge, because now our entire investment in our homes is at risk.
we're not sure that in some of these cases there is a good technical fix. I think that the sponsors have thrown out some good ideas here in terms of permit conditions, and these are the kind of conditions that we can incorporate into our permit process, and I'm sure State Parks can as well. May not fit all conditions, but certainly he's got some good ideas here in terms of the slope, in terms of the size of the rock, in terms of the fiber mat, so forth. We don't need the law to do that, and I'll take that back and get it in the hands of my permit staff to make sure that they review that and include those in wherever it's appropriate.
I think that's exactly what he had in mind. He realized that this was pushing way out, but at the same time hope to accomplish something by raising the issue back up, as Representative Thompson referred to, and then also the idea that his concern was that we're not, many times we're not doing this properly. And one of the issues, you know, because if in fact you had the right to put in a structure that did not until recently, you could still, because I think that was happening in Nesquim, where you have, and that's where I made reference to one homeowner being able to put up a structure, and then the next homeowner now having ways of being directed their way, possibly, but they cannot do that. And I think you're right. The best thing to do in those circumstances is stay back away from the edge.
And there's certainly that's some confusion for folks, because they'll see a house that just went up 6 years ago, and they'll wonder why they that built 15 years ago can't qualify for this. But supposedly they had the setbacks in their lot that these other folks didn't have. And, you know, we learn. It's an extremely dynamic environment out there, and it's not a place to be pushing the envelope, because what's pushing back at you is a body of water covering a third of the surface. pretty good-sized force. There are some, as Bob indicated, there's a goal exception process that's available. There's abilities to do things in a non-structural manner, and we do that in a number of areas with dune replenishment and planning that don't constitute that hardened structure that causes concern both with loss of the beach out in front of it as well as adverse impacts on adjacent properties. And there's opportunities to work with the transportation facilities. I think right now people are asking the question, well, we know the road was in there before 77.
Right.
Is it possible that perhaps this also qualifies for protected structures, although we don't want to leave with our chin there either, because that's a huge stretch of road.
That is the question I think we were trying to provoke also by this. Right now, what is that status? Because I contacted Gary Johnson or my office several times on this new lot issue, and I think there's a timidity to go out there, and then all of a sudden everybody in the world is attacking ODOT over attempting to save that road. And so, we were hoping this was maybe a little shield here.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator George, we have been meeting between ourselves, Parks, the governor's office, and ODOT to discuss the Beverly Beach Spencer Creek bridge situation, and try to find the combination approach that some of it may involve some of the relocation of the road, may have some structure down along the water, but we want to make sure that whatever we do there works technically, works financially, works environmentally as well.
Mr. Chairman, one quick follow-up. I when you look at that issue down there, you realize that the overall environmental concerns must be considered, because if you plow up through the middle of Beverly Beach State Park, you just wreck the state park, and then you're plowing through hill after hill after hill with drainage, and where when I fly, it does not look good to me to do that, and that's why, this is a push bill. And when he asked us to do this, I said, I think it's great, let's get it out there and discuss it.
We've got plenty of push going on. I don't know. I certainly appreciate the interest and the effort. I think that what we don't want to do is encourage new development to move any closer to the edge, and that's, I think, the concern that we've got, which is removing the prohibition altogether. Concern we've got with it.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Lockwood. We have two more, Mr. Kohlmeyer and Ms. Hartman, after this.
Thanks for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Jim Lockwood, Government Relations Manager, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. To be honest, I think really what I have to say has been said, in some cases more than once. I'm just glad that you're allowing a little pull with this push. I thought it was all push. And
no,
I was glad to get in, so I appreciate that. And really, I think I'll just save your time and leave it at that. Let's get ready for some parts.
Yeah.
Questions for Jim Lockwood?
Thank you.
Mr. Schoenmeyer. Well, Mike, you really amazed me a while ago, and I was very impressed because you were very short and concise. Are you going to be the same way this time?
Thank you.
Oh, boy.
Chair Carno and members of the committee, my name is Mike Schoenmeyer, and testimony is being submitted on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I have submitted written testimony, and due to the lateness of the hour,
just one. I want to ask, Mike. I know the particular bridge down there today that we've been talking about this evening that is somewhat in jeopardy. Do you folks within 1,000 Friends look at different pictures and different angles and that sort of thing? I know you do. Suppose you pull a bridge that needed some riprap around the edges of it, or an area where it's being eroded by something else. Do you even know what the problems are down there in this area?
Yes. In fact, I have discussed the Spencer Creek Bridge, Beverly Beach situation with ODOT officials, and as others have indicated, they and others are now trying to look at the best solution. We support a very careful evaluation to determine what the best solution is.
Okay, thank you very much.
I guess the point can be more direct, as I usually am, than my brother here to my right, is that 1,000 Friends isn't going to stand in the way of a public purpose need to do riprap, for instance, on 101 or on a bridge structure. Your opposition has more to do with
private property structure. Is that correct?
Our principal concern is that this bill would encourage new development that is, in our opinion, inappropriate and imprudent. And the answer to your question is that we, with respect to that situation, ODOT realizes that they may require an exception to Goal 18, and that may be part of the process. And we believe that the exception process on a case-by-case basis is the best way to determine whether or not the current requirements of Goal 18 should be relaxed in a certain situation, in a ODOT situation or in the CAPE situation. It should be on a case-by-case basis rather than changing the law to allow and almost to encourage beachfront protected structures in conjunction with new construction.
Michael, would you support the bill if in fact was amended to apply just to the protection of, in other words, existing rules would stay right in place and the time periods and the park sign-off and everything else, if this bill was in fact directed toward the preservation and protection of highways such as 101?
I believe I would still prefer to look at it on a case-by-case basis and go through the exception process rather than to make a broad rule that would apply to the highway.
I heard you talk about the highway and new construction. What if somebody wanted to save their property right now?
If that property was in existence, or if that development was in existence in 1977, the permitting process would allow a beachfront protective structure to protect that property.
That's not where I am, because that's already there. Like I said, you would agree to exceptions for like a highway, maybe, or that you don't want new development. When you meant new development, did you mean development since 77 you don't want to protect, or new people going to the beaches and jails? Who are the new people you don't want to protect?
It is not that I don't want to protect anyone. In 1977, when Goal 18...
I know all that.
That gave notice to people who were going to be developing along the coast that beachfront protective structures would not readily be available, that they would have to go through an exception process.
Okay. So new people, can you meet new people since 77? That's all I want to know.
Based upon the current implementation of Goal 18.
Yes. So you don't think exceptions should be for people since 77? Well, I was trying to get that. When you say new Union people that would want to build, they can build from this day forward, or people since they built since 77.
Chair Carnell, Senator Shannon, I believe the answer is that 1977 identified a benchmark, and from that time forward, the exception process would be used on a case-by-case basis. Prior to that time, beachfront development that was in place on the 1st of January 1977 doesn't have to go through an exception process. It has to go through a permitting process, but not an exception process for a beachfront protected structure to be permitted.
I don't make myself very clear. What I meant was that you said I would allow a case-by-case for the highway, but I was wondering if you would allow for case-by-case exception supported for people that had built since 77.
Yes.
Okay, that's all.
Okay. Anything else for Mr. Kohlmeyer? Michael, thank you. Ms. Hartman.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Senator, thank you for this opportunity. I just wanted to let you know that Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition, my name is Robin Hartman, Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition is opposed to this bill, and I would like to just summarize that it is just a broad brush approach to a solution, as a solution to something that may have been some problems that maybe can be addressed through the process that's already set up. But Oregon Shores, kind of our organization stands, really kind of tries to stand up for the beach law, and the public access and the things that protect Oregon's beaches, that make them really special in the nation, the work that has been done up till now, and the protection against riprap for structures after 1977 is part of what preserves them for Oregon's beaches for the public. So I just, that's about what I wanted to tell you.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman, I just asked the chairman if we might be able to do this, because I think everybody recognizes the need for in particular areas, other places where we don't want to see it looking like California or East Coast Shores. But I asked the chairman if we might consider someone from Thousands of Friends, Oregon Shores Coalition, ODOT, Parks, and DLTD, and a couple of committee members or a representative, sit together maybe Monday or Tuesday and see if there wasn't some way that we could come up with something that would particularly accomplish the issues relative to highways.
I'd be glad to talk to someone in the organization about that.
The chair will assign that responsibility to Senator George, and you can coordinate that activity with those folks.
Great, thank you.
Bob? Okay. Mike? Okay. Questions?
Paul?
Yes,
Paul. I wanted to point out to the chair that we're talking about an administrative rule that's going to be revised through those administrative processes, so you might want to consider that rather than going into the
I mean, it's a good issue in the shot with.
You need to go through the goal review process like they've done on the other one.
Right. Good point.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
And I agree with that. That's probably where we're going to end up. But right now, you know, we're here. And there's always that idea of, can we move this thing? Can you assure me? And so let's do that. We won't take a lot of time on this. And, you know, the bill just may go away. But I sure would like to sit down and see if we can't, you know, it bothered me that ODOT could not move on this thing. It felt very insecure. Must be some way to make it work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Sure. The only comment I would make is that's you know, honestly, the confusion I have is, did ODOT at some point ask DLCD or DSL to take some, you know, measures, protective measures on 101 or on those bridges, and they were told, you know, you have to go through the exception process, obviously, but they were told that the exception wouldn't be granted. Did they make application with an exception denied?
Or is this are we anticipating a problem that they haven't even faced yet?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cochran, the latter. They haven't even completed their evaluation about what approach they want to take, and then if they think that it's going to require a beachfront protective structure, then they're probably going to ask their attorneys, does the current law and goal allow them to do that? And then if they get a no answer, then they'll look at a goal exception process. So there's a number of steps that have to be taken.
The issue is that road has been falling away for about 15 years, and we've reached the point of critical mass on this thing. And what I'm suggesting is that maybe you need some orderly process to refer back to say, I think we're in trouble on this thing 15 years ago. And then could, in fact, begin to have a process. Rather than getting the emergency process.
Yeah, it was about 15 years ago when the road shut off from 101 at Turk Coast called Arizona Beach in Kerr County and killed two people, too.
Yeah.
And I would do it if that happens again on our coastline. I know that has been warned that they could be followed. Anyway,
they also did not move the road higher up the hill, and it slid away again about 4 years ago.
Yeah. Thank you, Robert. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.
Wait, let's go out and talk to the skateboarder. Who might have some ideas?